It was Shakespeare who said, "Parting is such sweet sorrow." The two things are just not compatible in your mind. Sweet sorrow, but then Shakespeare was Shakespeare. More recently, someone penned these words, "The saddest words I ever heard were words of parting." That's from the song, "Remember Me," you may remember. That's what we're talking about here today. We're talking about a goodbye, we're talking about parting. And Paul has a way of saying it that we need to hear. First of all, he says, there's a personal word, verses 20 to 22. Very personal to Philemon himself. And he says, "Provide me relief," verse 20. "Rejoice me in the Lord," in the first part. "Yeah, yes, brother, let me have joy from you in the Lord." Literally, he says, "I want to profit from you." That's the word, profit. "I want to profit from you." Now, Paul's not saying he wants to get rich off them, which I hear quite often on the TV. He's not saying, "I want to build a big ranch in Texas." He's not saying, "I want to build a $10 million church in Orlando." He's saying, "I want to profit from you in the Lord. I want to receive from you something that helps me in the Lord." And I take it he means in the Lord's work and in his walk with the Lord. And I find that in that verse, two words are emphatic. Now, by emphatic, one is there because it doesn't need to be. He just threw it in. And none of it is there by being out of line, out of place in the verse. The two words are these: "I and you." Now, what does that mean? Well, think about this. If I say to you, "I want to get something from you," what's that imply? You've been getting stuff from me. Now I want to get something from you. That's what he's saying. I want to get something from you. Now, it's been the reverse order, apparently. Paul led Philemon to the Lord. Isn't that wonderful? Yes. They had fellowship over the years, over the ages, hearing from each other, probably not contacting each other personally, but they knew about each other. They'd been following each other in the Lord. And remember, the burden of this letter is get the slave and the slave owner back together in fellowship, not just a physical level, but a spiritual level. Get the two back. I want to be profited by you. Now, do this. You owe it to me. I'm sure that that's it, back in the back of his mind because of those two things. Now, is there some further implication? Maybe. He may be saying in the back of his mind, "Send Onesimus to me." But that's not stated. He just says, "I'd like to." He said the last time he said, he stated pretty clear, carefully, but not here. But there's no further word on this matter. He's just saying, "I want to profit from you." And then he's saying, "Refresh me in the Lord." That's the last part of the verse. "Refresh my heart in the Lord." Again, it's my heart. "Refresh my heart in the Lord." The word "refresh" we saw recently, that Jesus used it. "Come unto me, all you that labor and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." That word "rest" is refreshment. And this is the same word. But then he says, "Refresh my heart." Now, that word "heart" we saw before too. It's not the cardia. It's not the thing that pumps blood. It's the splunkna. Somebody called it the nobler viscera. My kidneys, everything. That kind of thing. "Refresh me. I want to feel it." You know, when you saw her the first time, you saw him, you said, "Oh," and you got kind of sick to your stomach. "Oh," get pains in your stomach. That's it. That's the nobler viscera at work. And he says, "Refresh my splankna, where the affections and the sympathy are. It would refresh Paul to know that Philemon had accepted him. Paul had two sons, Philemon and Onesimus. Ah, the two of them. If I can just see them together. You ever have a situation where you saw, either you experienced or you saw, that two of your children were not getting along with each other? I'm talking about after marriage, really. They don't get along any time when they're little. But when after they're married, they just don't get along. You say, man, I wish they'd get together. You know, that can happen. And they can tear you up until one day it happens. It gets together. Well, that's what he's talking about. He wants them to get together and show love for one another. That's provide me with a relief, is what he's saying. Now, he also says, prove me right. Prove me right. In other words, I'm asking you to do something. Prove to me that you're going to do it. First of all, in the first part of verse 21, he says, having confidence in your obedience. You don't get things done by telling somebody, now I know you're not going to do this, but I want you to do it. No. I know you're going to do it. I have confidence in you. This is the way to lay things out. I'm going to embarrass somebody here. I have a friend, very close friend. I watch in a door in a restaurant, and this person will say, would you do so-and-so for me? Thank you very much. Before the person ever moves, thank you very much. Why? Because she's saying, I let it out. She's saying, I have confidence that you're going to do this. See? That's what he's saying here. I have confidence in you that you're going to do what I say. And then he goes on in the rest of the verse, verse 21, and he says, in a superlative obedience, I write to you knowing that you will do even more than I say. Even more. Go the extra mile, if you will. Jesus taught that, right, in Matthew 5. In verse 41, he says, whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Now, what that is, what he's referring to here is that a Roman soldier could come up to you in anywhere in Israel, anywhere where they are the in charge, and the Roman soldier could say, take my pack. You carry my pack for the next mile. And that was the law. He had to do it. So whatever you're doing, stop, take my pack 1 mile. So you get to the end of the mile, and Jesus said, now when you get to the end of the mile, don't just throw the pack down. Carry it, say, oh, I'll go 1 more mile. And the Roman soldier, what? Yeah, I'll go 1 more mile with you. That's what Jesus told him to do. Go 1 more mile. And we talk about it, going the extra mile. And then he says, before that, in verse 39, he had said, whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other one. Let him slap that too. I don't like that. No, that's doing more than he asked. And Paul said, I know you're going to do more than I ask. That doesn't seem fair, does it? No. In verse 40, he says, this is talking about Jesus still, if anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, give him your cloak also. I heard one man say, that is the answer. Jesus said, if anybody slaps you, let him slap you again. You have to go a mile, go another mile. If he takes your tunic, then he says, then take off your coat and let him have it. maybe you feel like doing that. That's not what Paul is saying. Paul is saying, no, I know you're going to do more. I believe that. So he's saying, prove me right. But then he's saying, prepare me a room. Plan on it. Meanwhile, he says, also prepare a guest room for me. Now, Philemon had a large room, a large house. He had remember, the church met there. So he had room for Paul. And Paul is inviting himself. I'll be there. Prepare the room. But Paul's in prison. How's he going to do that? Well, Paul has prospect of getting out soon. If we go on to Philippians, which we probably will, we'll see that he's expecting to be released. And so when he does, then he'll be able to move around. And so he's saying, prepare a room for me. But it seems to me there's something more than that. Don't you think? You two get together. Philemon, accept Onesimus as a brother. And by the way, I'll be there to see if you did it. I think I read that in there. So he's saying, plan on it. Plan on my being there. And then he said, pray for it. For I trust that through your prayers, I shall be granted to you. So pray that I get to come to see you. And of course, that prayer is two-pronged. Pray that I get out of jail, and pray that I get to come over there. Paul did get released. We'll talk about that in a minute. Paul would feel welcome. If you go to somebody's house and they say, we've been praying for you to come, would you feel welcome? That's what all this is involved, I think. But he is saying, don't punish Onesimus. Accept him as a brother. I'll be there. Pray about that. Now, Philemon may have been thinking, how does Paul know? Paul's in Rome. He'll never get out of there. They'll kill him, and then it's all over. See, Paul's saying, no, I'm going to come and look. Because people don't always do what you expect. They do what you inspect. And he's going to go inspect it. That's Paul's personal word. Then he has a public word. This public word, verses 23 and 24, is a greeting from a man in prison with Paul. Epaphras. He says, Epaphras, my fellow prisoner is in Christ Jesus, greets you. Now, who is Epaphras? Well, we've seen him before. We saw him in Colossians. And Paul says, Epaphras is one of you. So we know now that Epaphras was from the Colossae church. And he was called a bondservant of Christ, always laboring fervently for you in prayers, this is all from Colossians. He has a great zeal for you, Colossians, and for those in Laodicea, those in Hierapolis. These are cities of Lycus Valley. All those people, he had a great burden for them. And he may have been pastor of the Colossae church. Perhaps he came to Rome to see Paul about the Gnosticism that was creeping into the Colossian church. Some reason he was there meeting with Paul. So, that's the man in prison with Paul. Now, there's a greeting from the men who were partner with Paul. Marcus was one. Marcus, my fellow laborer. We mentioned Mark before in the connection with Barnabas. Remember, he quit in the middle of Paul's first missionary journey. And sometimes that's what people see, that's all that people see about Mark. That's not the whole story. Now you're going to hear the rest of the story. Yeah? We want to know something about before his defection. What did he do before that? I found the little verse. I love it. In Mark, chapter 51. It says this. Now a certain young man followed them, having linen cloth thrown about his naked body, and the young men laid hold of him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. Now that's when the soldiers' temple came to get Jesus and crucify him. Well, this is what Mark records about somebody who did that. Now, who was that? Well, I think that young man was Mark. And here's my and others scenario about this. Several things follow. Mark was the son of the owner of the house where they had the Last Supper, the Passover, and they initiated the Lord's Supper. He learned about Judas' plan. So I think that the Jesus and the disciples were having this thing, but it was at his house. They may have observed what was going on. So he learned about Judas' plan to betray Jesus. And Judas left dinner ahead of everyone. Remember, we know that. And he thought that Jesus was still there. So, but Jesus and his disciples went to the Mount of Olives. Remember that? And because Judas left and didn't know, after Mark knew about the destination. So after they left, Mark went undressed, went to bed. And then Judas told the Jewish leaders and to go to that house. That's where Jesus is. You can take him right there. And the leaders came with their soldiers, knocked on the door. Mark got up, and they asked where Jesus was, and Mark told them. The soldiers and all that, middle of the night, yeah, I'll tell you. So then he thought, wow, they're after Jesus. And so he threw a sheet about him, and ran out there to warn Jesus. But he was too late. And a soldier saw him and grabbed the sheet, and he ran away naked. Now, why do I bring all that up? It took a courageous boy to do that. Young man, actually. To run out there and tell, there are the soldiers, they're running to get Jesus. So he runs out there and going to tell Jesus. Too late, they already have him. And so he runs away. But that showed courage. That's the Mark we're talking about. That Mark that failed. Well, the Mark didn't fail here. He was a good, courageous young man. And then I say, how could anyone else know about this? It's not in any other gospel. And he doesn't say who it was. He just says, a young man did this. Yeah, sure, it was Mark, so I think. So why do I bring it up here? I wanted to show you that Mark was not a coward. This is before his failure. Now, after the failure even, we find the same Apostle Paul saying good things about Mark. Colossians 4:10. Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, about whom you received instruction. If he comes, welcome him. Well, 2 Timothy 4:11. He tells Timothy, come to me, and get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful for me in the ministry. So here, in Philemon, Paul is calling him my fellow laborer. You know what? I think that's the best. With all the other things, I think that's the best one. He's a fellow laborer with Paul. Oh yeah, he failed Paul. He failed the Lord. But he now is a fellow minister with the Apostle Paul. Do you know something else? Peter. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 14. Let's put this in here this morning. Peter calls him, Mark, my son. He's been there with Peter, working with Peter. Probably amanuensis with him, secretary. So Mark was with Peter, apparently working with him. And then Mark wrote the Gospel of Mark, of course. And he was Peter. Peter was the eyewitness when he wrote the book of Mark, I take it. All of that is to say this. One failure, but look at all this success, before and after. So failure, then, is neither fatal nor final. That's Mark. Aristarchus, my fellow laborer. Colossians 4:10, he says about Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner. Acts 19:29, Aristarchus was with Paul during the Ephesian riots. And when they went to get Paul, they didn't get him, they got Aristarchus instead. And you could say that he took the fall for Paul. Yeah? And later in Acts, we see him as he traveled with Paul to Rome. He was there. Perhaps a prisoner as well. He says in verse Acts 27:2. So entering into the ship of we put into sea, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia, and Aristarchus was with us. So Aristarchus was with him during the trip, during the shipwreck, all of that. Aristarchus was there. He is a fellow prisoner, and now he is a fellow laborer. maybe a fellow prisoner literally as well as figuratively. There's two more. One says, Demas, my fellow laborer. In Colossians, we read the same thing about him. Demas, my fellow laborer. So, a good laborer, apparently. After Paul had written Philippians, the last of the prison epistles, he was released from prison for 2 years. 2 years later, he was picked up again and taken to Rome. When he wrote 2 Timothy, he was near the time of death. He says, it's my time of my departure is at hand. So when he wrote 2 Timothy, he was near the end. And in chapter 4, he penned these fatal words. And they are, Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. So Demas, I hope Demas found like Mark did. Maybe he turned around. But here, it's a sad picture. If I put myself in there, I want to go to tears. Paul, the apostle, is by himself, except for one. And that's Luke. Luke, my fellow laborer. We know that Luke was Paul's faithful physician. And we read in 2 Timothy, only Luke stood with me. Wow. All these people, my fellow workers and all of that, only Luke. Luke stood with me. Then he comes to a parting word. A parting word in verse 25. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ be with your spirit. A short greeting. But it could not have been more important if it had been a whole book. One little sentence, one little word, grace. The most important blessing God gives us is grace. Without grace, we wouldn't exist for a moment. It's not more than just salvation by grace, but every day we need God's grace. See? I'm reminded of more than just salvation by grace. Two other graces come to mind. Sharing grace. Dr. Charles Stanley. No. My other good friend, Jeremiah, is doing a whole series, I think about 10 sermons on giving. Permit me the next 5 minutes. Two graces. One of them is sharing. Sharing grace. And I want to give you a whole context on this, what I'm going to say. Here it is. It's in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. And he says this. Moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, that in great trial of affliction and abundance of their joy, and their deep poverty, abounded in riches of their liberality. I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, beyond their ability, they were freely willing, imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the administering of the saints. Please take my money. That's what they were. And not only said they that they had hoped, not only as we had hoped, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. So we urged Titus that as he had begun, so he would complete this grace in you as well. But as you abound in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in diligence, and in your love for us, see that you abound in this grace also. It's not a chore. It's a grace. Now, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but it's important that we understand that giving, the grace of giving, is a privilege that the Lord gives us. And we see it as a grace, not a chore, something that we do. But then there's also serving grace. You've heard this, one of my favorite things to say. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us hold fast to grace, by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Now that's my translation of that passage, of that verse. You get all kinds of different translations. Let us be gracious. whatever, all kinds of things. But to me, that hold fast to grace is what he's saying. So he's saying, serve God. Hold fast to grace that you may serve God acceptably. We can't serve God keeping the law. We can't do it. We can't serve God if we're holding on to the Mosaic law. That's the whole. That's what the whole book's about. Understand the grace. Accept the grace. But also accept that there is a serving grace that goes with it. The giving grace, the serving grace, all there. So, he says, grace, this grace, be with your spirit. Again, he's not talking physically. He's talking spiritually. The results, saving, sanctifying, sharing, serving, all of that are the results of this grace in your spirit. So he had a personal word. The personal word was about me, Paul. The public word was about others. And the parting word was about God, God's grace. Yep, parting is such sweet sorrow. But one day, no more parting. Like the bald head. His head resembles heaven, for there'll be no parting there. We have friends who are with us often, and before we leave, somebody will start, see you here, and then everybody joins in, here, there, or in the air. Parting, that's what that's about. We may see you again here. We may see you again there. But we're all going to see you one day in the air. And that's what we look forward to. That's our greeting, which is not sorrow. That is a sweet one. And we'll see it.